This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 88th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have today with me Christian Kohlberg. Hi, Christian.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Christian Kohlberg is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Arizona. His PhD is from Lund University in Sweden, and he's worked at the University of Auckland in New Zealand and at the Chinese Academy of Science in Beijing. Christian's work focuses on software protection, tamper-proofing, and watermarking. He co-authored the book Surreptitious Software, which is part of the Addison Wesley Software Security series that I edit. Christian travels extensively, having visited 31 countries, plays guitar in the band The Undecidables, and enjoys baking and photography. He lives in Arizona, where it is a balmy 100 and what right now?
I'm not sure. It's nice and cool inside, I tell you that.
You're not going to admit it, are you?
No.
So
the dry heat.
When you were a student in Sweden, what made you choose computer science, and then why computer security after that?
That's completely random. Some friend of mine said, you know, computer science is interesting. You should try to take some classes. And I was going to do physics at the time, but never made it past computer science. I just got caught up. And I was never doing security at that point. I was a compiler weenie and did my thesis on modularity. And it was much later in life that I stumbled into computer security.
Okay. So did you do any computer science stuff when you were a kid? Any coding? Did you have a computer?
Not at all.
So it was all university related?
Right. Fortran 4 on punch cards.
Did you keep track of that friend of yours?
Yeah, he's still in computer science, doing really well.
Uh-huh. And then computer security, when did that come about?
I was at University of Auckland at the time, and had some student come in and wanted to do a project, and I said, sure, and never saw him again until the end of the semester when he handed me a report and talked about security in Java, and I started reading that. And it's one of those rare situations when a student does a lot of work by themselves and, you know, actually does a really good job with it. And that started me thinking about security of Java and from, you know, language point of view.
Yeah. That's how I got started in computer security too, ironically. And all those same bugs that we found a million years ago, they're coming right back around.
Of course.
It's as if nothing happened for 20 years. So you've lived in four countries, Sweden, New Zealand, China, the United States. Can you compare and contrast academia in those countries?
Well, what I find different in the United States is that compared to Europe is an emphasis on systems research. But I've been working in Europe, and I was in Italy for a while working on a European project. It's a lot of work on modeling and theory, whereas in the U.S. we tend to, you know, we build a system and then we measure it. And that's the kind of work that I really enjoy. The Chinese have an overburdened educational system. That's really their problem. They have, you know,
just too many people.
Very, very young population, and that's really hampering their situation right now.
So, would that mean, from your perspective, not enough ability to do research because you're too busy teaching?
Too busy teaching and also too busy making a living. Professors there have to typically work outside in order to, you know, feed their families, and so that really hampers their ability to do research. Now, there's plenty of good work being done there, but for the average professor is busy, you know, just making a living.
Right. So, to boil it all down, what makes you stay in the U.S. And be an academic here?
Well, I'm very lucky to be at a university where I have some very excellent colleagues, and I like the academic freedom that we have here, which is you know, a little bit different than in other countries. The fact that I can come to work every day and do exactly what I want, you know, it's a great privilege.
And you're leaving tomorrow for a sabbatical.
Well, actually, I'm leaving tomorrow to go to China. We, for the last couple of years, we've been running the summer school, and it started out in China, in Beijing, and next year we were in Belgium and in Arizona, and now we're back in China, in Xi'an. So we're going there for a week with another couple of people from the West to teach about software security.
Your book, Surreptitious Software, brings together multiple threads, software protection, tamper-proofing, watermarking, and it covers a ton of ground. But where did the title come from?
I just like the idea of alliteration, I suppose.
So has that idea, surreptitious software, the concept caught on, you think?
Definitely. I mean, it's the thing about surreptitious software or anti-tamper, whatever software protection, whatever you want to call it, is that it's used by both the good guys and the bad guys. And unfortunately, the bad guys seem to make better use of it than the good guys.
How so?
Well, you know, any virus or any malware needs to protect itself from analysis, right? They need to hide themselves, they need to be stealthy, and they obfuscate themselves, they tamper-proof themselves, and so on. And their job is a little bit easier than our job, I think, and so they tend to do a better job at it.
So let's talk about these three major threads in turn. So first, software protection, which involves obfuscation, anti-reversing, all that stuff. Do you think software protection is an aspect of software security?
Oh, absolutely.
And what's the state of the practice in software protection these days?
We tend to call man at the end attack, or mate attack these days, just to see that it's actually just an aspect of software protection or software security. You know, we have man in the middle attacks, and then you have the man at the end attacks, which is really just, you know, an insider attack, right? The problem is that much of the good research in this area is going on in industry, and they're really not publishing. And so the question is difficult to answer. I mean, I can tell you what's going on in academia, but what I know what's going on in industry, I cannot tell you about.
Yeah, I know there's some products that offer software protection for mobile devices, like ArcSan has one and others.
Exactly.
What do you think of those?
Well, if they would give me a copy to reverse engineer, I'd be able to tell you, but of course they don't.
So they're, you think they're relying on security by obscurity when they shouldn't be?
So actually, I talked to a colleague at one of those companies, and he said, you know, this security by obscurity gets a bad rap, right? In our area, we tend to protect things for a fairly short period of time. If you're protecting a game, for example, if you can protect it for 3 weeks rather than 2 weeks, now suddenly you're making a profit.
Oh, heck,
not making
yeah,
a profit.
2 days will do you for a game.
Exactly, right? And so if security through obscurity, not telling your adversary exactly what you're doing, buys you another day or two, in that domain, it actually helps. And same in the military, right? If you can protect your secret a couple more days, until your attack, certainly you've been helped, right?
I think that's true. I think the only problem with security by obscurity is if you have broken security mechanisms and you're counting on the fact that they're obscure to stop people from outing you, right? So security by obscurity is powerful only if you have security mechanisms that actually work in the first place. Then you can
Absolutely.
Keep a secret. Yeah. So the military seems to have played a big role in developing software protection schemes, especially after the Chinese forced down a spy plane of ours for 24 hours a few years ago. What are your views on the commercial prospects for software protection schemes?
I think infrastructure protection is a huge deal these days. I was listening to your one of your early podcasts that talks about power meters and protection of those.
Oh yeah.
And really, again, you have a man at the end attack, right? You have a meter sitting outside your mom's house, and you can sit in your basement and hack into that at will. And so really, you need tamper-proofing and anti-analysis techniques to protect those.
Yeah, I was going to talk about tamper-proofing a little bit. Tamper-proofing is another key technology you've worked on. What is the state of the practice in tamper-proofing, and how does that relate to your work on what I'm going to call attacker at the end attacks?
Well, a lot of what people do, of course, is just various hashing techniques. They build guards and guard networks. You hash a piece of code, and you check whether the hash has the right value or not, and then you build networks of these, so the guards check each other.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have variations of these, like diversity techniques to generate large numbers of different types of guards.
How much of tamper-proofing is software-related, and how much is physical system-related, and how do those two interact?
Well, there's certainly both kinds, right? I mean, there are lots of people who, in the past, used dongles for protection. But in the end, the dongle has to communicate with the software that you're trying to protect,
mm-hmm.
and so you have to protect that link, and that's often where the attack goes in.
Right, you just become the serial port.
Right. Yeah. So you have to protect every link on the chain.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. What do you suppose is the state of the art in tamper-proofing these days?
Again, it's very, very difficult to say because you mentioned ArcSan, and there are other companies that do this metaphoric, do the same thing.
And I think Mokana does some stuff like that too.
Right, Ardetto and so on. And it's very difficult to say exactly what they're doing without reverse engineering their tools.
It's funny. It seems like they would want someone like you to give them a thumbs up. Approved by Christian Kohlberg.
What they tell me is that, they develop these techniques, and, everybody in the room, is very happy about, all the techniques they develop, and then some other guy walks in the room and finds a way around it.
Right.
So something might have appeared secure for, a long period of time, but it only takes one guy to look at it slightly differently for, this house of cards to fall down.
Right, right. And is there theory in the academic research that helps to avoid that problem?
Well, what we're working on right now is replaceable security, updatable security. So we're building the system for protecting, say, online games, where we automatically replace the software protection, at whatever frequency you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if someone can hack into our system, and we expect that they can crack it eventually, by the time they cracked it, we've replaced it.
Right.
I think that's a technique that will become more and more important.
Right. So you just basically keep moving target.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think
moving target defenses.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people that are thinking about moving target and security these days. Let's talk about watermarking a bit. Watermarking plays a role in many copyright enforcement schemes. Is the legal domain interested in this technology as the world moves to things like cloud documents and, trying to figure out which document's real and so on?
It's interesting you're saying that because we're actually working on a project just like that. We're working on provenance. So you're working on a Microsoft Word document, and it keeps track of everything that you're doing. Now, maybe if you're a bad guy, maybe in your interest to change this provenance. And so now again, you have a man at the end attack, an insider attack, where you need to protect this provenance from being modified.
Mm-hmm.
And so we actually have a system that does that, that works on OpenOffice.
Yeah, it seems like the legal community would be particularly
right.
Interested in that.
Now, if you break through this type of protection, you can still get the document out, you can modify the provenance. And so in addition to software protection, we actually watermarking the documents. And so get multiple levels of protection to make sure that this provenance is secure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's change channels a little bit. So, how do you teach computer security? to students, undergrads?
Well, I start by teaching them how to pick locks, actually.
Oh, do you really? Wow, that's interesting.
And so, because without physical security, you can have no virtual security. And they're very excited about that. And I also teach them to crack code. So, you know, I give them a protected binary, an x86 binary, and I say, go at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, modify it so that, you know, you can still run it without entering the secret codes or whatever.
Right.
The kind of hacking that you might have done in the old days on your Apple computer to get past the games, right?
Indeed. That's how I got started with Greg Morissette 20 trillion
exactly.
years ago.
but most students haven't had that experience because all their programming has been in Java or other high-level languages. So the idea of modifying x86 instructions on the fly is very alien to them. And so,
right.
But that's something that they need to know how to do. And so I have developed a set of exercise that does exactly that.
Do you think you can teach people to think like an attacker, or is that sort of an innate capability?
There are certainly people who are better at it than others, naturally evil people. But I think you can definitely teach them to think, adversarially.
Yeah. So. Especially if you give them some particular attacks and say, think about these attacks every time you build something. I used to think that teaching attack was absolutely essential and that you could not do computer security for developers even without teaching about attacks. But Steve Lipner changed my mind about that. And so I'm curious if you think we should try to teach developers about attacks so they know why we're teaching them how to code properly or not.
I think definitely so. And one of the things that I teach my students, and it's always on the final exam, is draw this attack tree. I'll paint up a scenario for them and find all the possible ways to reach a certain attack goal. And it's amazing how bad some students are at doing this. I think you just need to have a lot of experience in thinking adversarially, to think like an attacker.
Yeah, so I agree with that, but the real question is whether you can teach it, like whether you can actually improve somebody's capability or if you're just enhancing their natural propensity in the first place.
Well, a lot of it is just enumerating all possible paths in an attack graph.
Uh-huh.
Right? So, what are all the possible ways to accomplish a certain goal? And I think that can be, if not taught, so at least you can practice it.
Got it. Well, an even harder thing to teach. So how do you teach security design? Is it something that can be done? Does anybody do it?
Well, can you teach design in general?
I don't know. I mean, they try to teach architects design to some extent. And I think they do that by mostly making you cry with, you put stuff on the wall and you get juried and people make you cry. And you do that for 5 years, and then you can be an architect.
Right, and still most buildings look like they were made out of Lego blocks.
Exactly. So we don't know whether you can teach design. In my experience, it seems like what happens is people code, they work on systems for years, and 1 year they turn around and there are 15 guys following them saying, hey, how do you do this? So you are a creative person with great work in photography and music and presumably baking too, although I haven't ever had any of your baking. And you're well traveled. What's the most interesting place you've ever visited and why?
I think Mongolia certainly is a place worth visiting. It's a place where you live on the edge. You don't know how long you're going to survive. This is one time that I thought I might die on a mountain, and you get a snowstorm in the middle of August. As a result, it's a very fatalistic people.
Huh.
But it's a wonderful place.
Because the world might turn on you at any second.
And it does, yes.
Oh, that's interesting. How about in the United States, if you had to pick the most interesting place you've ever visited in the U.S., what would that be?
Oh, Tucson, Arizona, of course. we should all visit, and like we say, it's a dry heat.
What was the temperature again today?
Balmy 105.
Wonderful. Last question. It's kind of a crazy one. Do you watermark your own digital content that you have on the net, on your website?
Absolutely not.
Well, why not?
Well, we academics, we like to share, right? I think it's important as an academic that we share everything that we do and, you know, to allow people to reproduce the work that we do. And so, you know, at most I put the copyright notice on my slides, but nothing more than that.
That's very interesting. That tells you a lot about software protection as a discipline right there, I think.
Maybe so.
Well, thanks for your time today. It's been interesting, Christian.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. Ironically, the May-June issue of IEEE S&P features special coverage of privacy and online social networks, edited by Susan Landau. Timely in light of the NSA? Yes, it is. The issue also features our chat with anti-cyberwar scholar Thomas Ridd. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.